Good morning, still morning, everyone, and welcome to the morning session of the 37th Annual U.S. Psychotronics Association Conference in Chicago 2015. We are honored today to have our new president speak this morning to us, John Climo. John is a world-renowned authority on channeling and the author of three books and numerous articles on the subject. He has also teaching this work in doctoral programs for the last 40 years in California and Rutgers, and most recently at the American School of Professional Psychology. John has chaired over 2,000 doctoral
dissertations. No, 200. 200. Couldn't have done 2,000.
200.
Couldn't have handled
200.
It.
Yeah. Right, sorry. And has done research and teaching and public presentations and published in the area of parapsychology, complementary alternative medicine, consciousness studies, the new science, ufology, metaphysics, etc. This list goes on and on. And I don't want to take up more of John's time, but he has appeared on a lot of numerous radio and TV shows throughout the country, and today he's going to talk to us about idealism of engineering and non-locality. Welcome, John.
Thank you. So, I hope you don't get too attached to the languaging. I use language primarily as a poet, but after 40 years in academia, I've learned to use language in service of a lot of other things as well. It's a multi-purpose tool, but my real heart lies with the poetry and the spiritual and the larger reality. I just started a foundation a year ago called the Larger Reality Foundation, where I'd like to help people like us to do these kinds of things and empower us in the areas where we've never been empowered, like financially, to survive and flourish in ways we haven't been able to survive so far as well. Some of you have heard me talk before, some haven't. I operate somewhat differently than other people. Well, I essentially open myself to be worked through, I guess you could say. I don't channel entities. I don't really consider myself a channel any more than I consider any of you. We're all channels in this regard. But the I like Aldous Huxley's metaphor of mind at large in capital letters. And there's mind at large out there. And it comes through the reducing valve, like a reducing valve that each of us has. Each of us is or has a reducing valve. And mind at large comes through the reducing valve. And you can dilate manipulate the reducing valve a certain amount to let more or less of mind at large through. And my prayer for decades has been, please help me, show me how to dilate the reducing valve. And I'll take my chances that enough of a cosmic dump may come in that I may lose my mind occasionally. And you know it's happened. I train clinical psychologists, and I've been a mental health consumer as well as a teacher of how to do mental health for other people. So you can lose your mind, and it for me it was worth the price because I'm no longer afraid of losing control. At the same time, I want to reach people who need to have me be in control to be understood by them. And so over the decades, I've learned to what I call tight and loose people and loosen tight people. And that includes helping people do a dissertation, which is, did I stop doing it? No. So I have to tighten my loose self very often. So a PowerPoint, I'm going to qualify this. I'm going to use aspects of this PowerPoint, and if it frustrates you that I'm not sticking to the PowerPoint or whatever, I'm going to ask you, please, to follow up on this and email me, and the email is on the slides here, and I will send you this PowerPoint, because I'm not going to be able to, in the 45 minutes, 38 minutes left or whatever, to go through every single slide and do it justice or read what was on the slide. I don't have to do that. Go to my website also, which is on one of these slides that you can get. Or I can get it, give it to you after the talk. And my website has many, many papers, but two books worth right now, mostly unpublished, that are a great many of them are about this topic. And so if I don't adequately treat in 37 minutes now, the topic of idealism and how it relates to things like radionics and classical and quantum physics and so on, I'll be glad to do that for you. You can follow up with me that way. Another thing I want to qualify, it's a hopeless enterprise to try to do justice to all these slides or to the topic itself, but I'm letting go of that, and I hope you'll let go of it too and enjoy the idiosyncrasies of me and what I'm doing here, because I am idiosyncratic as all get out. But I will. You can get the other side too. You can get the left brain part and the right brain part and the presence and the experiential part and also the linear part. I'm not very linear. Those who need linearity, I'll step through some of these, but I'll just have to just let go of the rest of them, have you let go of the rest of them, and come back to them on your own when you get them in the email from me. Okay. I also have to qualify that I'm a little out of it, more than maybe usual, because I'm. I did the Coast to Coast AM show last night. I mean, this morning, 4 hours ago, 2 to 4 a.m. Chicago time, and I'm kind of frazzled from it. I try to get a little nappy time before and after for this talk. So I really wanted to do well. You know, my prayer is, please use me and help me be of service to others and. An instrument of your will, and I want to be your son in whom you're well pleased, but I need some help with that. I need some sleep and things, you know, and I can't always control all that. So I got a foot in two or three different worlds in the sense of I can be a left-brained academic, and I'm connected to the classical and non-classical physics and interdisciplinary fields of sciences to a certain extent. Philosophy, I'm a frustrated philosopher. I'm especially a poet more than anything else, where my heart is with a poet in me. And I bring that to talks like these. And so I usually can get a sense that when people can't get on the wavelength that I'm mainly coming from because it's too one thing or too another thing. But over the decades of public speaking and teaching, I throw a multi-wave oscillator is, Minkowski multi-wave oscillator. I am a kind of a Minkowski multi-wave oscillator. I send a lot of frequencies out there that resonate at the fundamental frequencies of the in you, across the levels of you. I'm saying figuratively too, because this is not just physical body, but your subtle bodies. And it reminds the parts of you that are no longer stepping to those resonant frequencies in a God-given healthy rate manner. You're out of whack with them. So if it comes through me. The healthy frequency, the treat frequency, so to speak, which I'm not in control of. I just say let them work through me, and I want to be a vehicle to do that. I try to do that too. So I try to use myself that way, or be used that way more accurately in these talks. And the only way this sometimes works is having to sort of hitch my wagon to a star, throw caution to the winds, and say, please use me. I can't handle this all myself. I can't speak fast enough, and I'm always accused of talking too fast, and I'm trying to go slow here, but I can't go slow. I'm down to 29 minutes probably at this point. So just get a taste of it. Get a taste of me. It's a style. It's a bit different. And I think from all I've looked around to see, there aren't many people doing it the way I do it, whatever, because I'm doing me. I'm doing it. It is me. But I see how all the other it's, the other you's do your thing, and we're all in it together, and we're like a bunch of all these oscillators oscillating and resonating each other and seeking some kind of attractor in the chaos and in the coherence building as we evolve. So I think I can handle things for the remainder of the time here, but I want to set a few things out here, and I'll actually read a few of them. So I'm going to jump down more into a linear mode, a more grounded mode, and since you're going to have all these slides anyway, you can come back and read these more carefully, and I can't read all the details of them, but let's see, am I upside down or upside down? to learn the nature of creation and how to thankfully and responsibly work with it in service to other is what I'm about the business of, and I've tried to fine-tune that and to tune into to the guidance to follow up on that intentionality to do the best job I can of that. And I really want to, like on my website, it says, I want to know how God works. That's what I'm in, what I'm here to do. I want to understand not God over there, but how my creator, our creator, operates and how his, its creation functions. And since I'm a chip off the old block and I want to be in alignment with that and do good work by those means, I need head understanding, I need heart allegiance and following. I even need my poor little abused body to be an instrument enough to do that justice. To learn the nature of our creator and our relation to its offspring, us. Non-locality, I've written about this, it's all over the place, the literature is full of it. I cannot go into the details, but you know what a hypertext is, where you can click on a thing and it goes into the other thing? I spent a whole day when I first came out to California with Ted Nelson, who invented hypertext. It was his baby. He was trying to get through graduate school, and he trying to take notes on things, and his head worked that way. And so my head works that way. So we got along great. Why do I mention that? Non-locality. How your head works. I could click on each of those things and go into it and then branch off from that and off of that, and that's the way my head works. The problem is, unfortunately, it's simultaneous. And that's your problem too, not just my problem. So better to let it come out simultaneously, more superimposed, and let you pick and choose, or let the Lakowski multi-wave oscillator kind of radiate over you, than to... lost my train of thought there. So the non-separability, phase entanglement, bosonic. I love bosons. I study them as best I can, and it's light. It's non-fermionic. Fermions are responsible for mass and for matter, and they obey the Pauli exclusion principle, meaning they can't occupy the same quantum space. Or even physical space, and so they separate apart and they make spatiality, they make matter, they make this level of density as we know it. But when you move to a bosonic level, bosons are the opposite of fermions. They like to all crowd together. They don't hang out in one thing. They could. Einstein, Podolsky, Rosenberg, Bell, Aspic, the different experimental verifications that there is action at a distance, there is a kind of a field effect, that we're all in this together, all animate, inanimate, sizes, shapes, fractal levels of that. As a parapsychologist, parapsychological evidence for non-local information processing and diagnoses, and remote viewing, ESP, telepathy, clairsentience, applied kinesiology using yes-no interrogation to get at kind of omniscient field of the universal. These are aspects of non-locality. Radionics, I think, is probably the best single example of engineering non-locality in a predictable and efficacious way. And like Ronnie Dangerfield, it don't get no respect, usually, unless you're in the field. So I would hope with this organization we can bring some understanding to a larger population about things like radionics, and by their fruits they shall be known and the efficacy shall be shown. And that's what I look forward to. What is idealism? It's a highfalutin term. It's a philosophical term. I'll get to the Eastern versions of it, which are a little more user-friendly than the Western, but mental monism, it means everything is mental, everything is mind, the whole universe, you could say it's all God stuff, but that might put off some kind of more other types, so just everything is mind, is consciousness. So idealism in Britannica is, in philosophy, can you hear me when I turn away like this? It's okay. In philosophy, any view that stresses the central role of the ideal or the spiritual in the interpretation of experience, it may hold that the world or reality exists essentially as spirit or consciousness. The abstractions and laws are more fundamental in reality than sensory things, or at least that's whatever exists in our dimension that are chiefly mental. I'm blocking some of that up with the picture. Sorry, but everything is mental. I'll also use Bishop Berkeley, George Berkeley, the philosopher, and I'll use some Eastern examples of that. And then I'll probably take leave of the slides because I'm going to be running out of time. I'll have to do something else to get at the other essences I want to get at. In the Eastern traditions, Indian Vedic science, Upanishads, Brahman being, Vedanta, Kashmir Shaivism, I'll quote from some of this. In the West, Berkeley, my personal favorite is George Hegel. And I use Hegel a lot in my thinking and my writing. Hegel believed, he was a German idealist, that he believed that everything is not just consciousness, but everything is absolute spirit. Everything is essentially homogeneous absolute spirit. And in its thesis state, the whole universe, all that exists, all that could possibly be, is absolute spirit. Throughout itself, knowing it is absolute spirit. Isn't that wonderful? If we could ever get there. But what happens is it gets dissociated from itself, it gets in an antithesis state, and we forget that we are that absolute spirit, and then there's this dissociation, we're trying to overcome the dissociation and reconnect to ourself. And that's animate-inanimate bridging. It's not just mind-body and so on. It's this is all dense consciousness stuff, and I'm but it's not just consciousness, it's spirit. If you want to reduce everything into energy, that sort of takes the life out of things, even if you're calling it energy. If you call it all mind, in a sense, that takes the heart out of it. That's why it's hard for me to avoid the spirit and the spiritual. And so I like Hegel because he uses the term spirit, an absolute spirit. But that's not that we start off with. The presenting problem for us as a species and for other extraterrestrials and anybody around the universe at different levels of density and embodiment is to go home to overcoming the dissociation away from that absolute spirit state and awareness of that spirit. And so that's what we're about the business of. That's what our science is trying to do and what our religion and spiritual practices have been trying to do. In quantum physics, the idealism, the animations idealism in the, I can't turn that thing, I'm blocking some of it, that there's a need for an observer, a conscious observer in experiments and observations and the like. So you can't keep consciousness out of Western physics anymore. The motivations of idealism, are all of these things partly blocking the image by the text? Well, I think it'll work. To transform all pieces comprising the physical universe, what am I doing? To transform all pieces comprising physical reality into the corresponding symbols representing them in the mind, and then in turn seeing through them to face the virtual undifferentiated living universal presence in which all objectively real appearing things populating an external reality and all the creations of inner imaging, mentation, and ideation have their existence in one all-subsuming consciousness field. That's the modus operandi, that's the game plan, that's the homeward boundness of idealism. It could be called religion, it could be called spirituality too, I suppose. These are the things and please, if I just leave you hanging and hit you in the face with all this stuff and you can't follow it and you're saying that wasn't very nice to what he did, please, I'm sending you to all the hypertext, click on zoom in detail and exemplification. So don't not do this, because I have to, by letting go of things, I can't do all the specificity here. But I will give you more damn specificity than you can handle, because I'm good at specificity too. And I have a high baud rate of bringing it in and a high rate of sending it out. But I can't do all that either, because I can check around and I half of you are not following that much of that anyway. So my website, www.johnklimo.com, has a couple of books worth of this kind of stuff on it, beyond my published stuff. And my email address is just my name, johnklimoidealism, @gmail.com. And so that's how to get the slides, that's how to get the detail, the stuff I'm not going to be able to get to here. Okay, there's a slow shift in the worldview, in our consensus reality, and our science behind it. The paradigm of materialism or physical reductionist monism, everything reduces down to physicality, continues to still overwhelmingly dominate our Western science and technology. But there's now a gradual movement from pure materialism into kinds of dualism, and more recently into a kind of growing non-local, holistic, post-materialist, holographic, implicate order, et cetera, model. Nonetheless, most of us, and primarily our scientists and academics, continue to refuse to accept the ultimate reality as pictured by a fully robust idealism. I was went for a walk with a philosopher, a colleague of mine at Rutgers when I was a professor there, and I brought up idealism and Hegel, and he said, oh, when I was PhD student at Columbia, we used to laugh about Hegel. He's crazy, he's psychotic. You know, idealism sounds kind of crazy for some people. I think reductionist materialism is psychotic, frankly. It's going the opposite direction, away from reality and away from substance and meaning. And contemporary Oxford philosopher John Foster, probably our best known philosopher of idealism, and who cares, and all these big words and things like that, who cares. I still care because I'm trying to do about five things at once, including reach the academic community, reach higher education, reach the scientific community, reach the left brain analytical types, reach the materialists, to help shepherd through a post-materialist renaissance of spiritual growth, of higher dimensional experiencing and living and understanding. And this is one of the cylinders you need to fire on, to like the multiwave oscillator, to remind people that the different levels and the interrelation of them. The ultimate reality, this is Foster, the ultimate reality is wholly mental, wholly non-physical, consisting of mental entities and mental facts and mental governing and mind-governing and mind-governed laws existing in mind and ultimately in the mind of God. The physically relevant structure of the underlying external reality is that structure under which the reality is empirically represented at the human viewpoint. That structure is under which the reality is disposed to reveal itself through the constraints on human experience. The creation of a physical world necessarily involves the encoding of a physical structure by the experience of constraints. Now that may sound like gobbledygook to you, but we're only capable of experiencing what we experience under the constraints, these experiential constraints. They constrain our experience. And we want to break free from that. God knows I did. That's why I used to go crazy. I wanted to just kind of get out of the box of it. I was suffocating. I was homesick. This wasn't home. And I kept, working against all this, these constraints. I still am. But I kind of let go into it because that's the presenting problem I need to be working with, and needing to work with fellow human beings to remind them, like Plato said, remember, you already know it, remember? these constraints, where do they exist? Are they just in our minds, these cognitive self-constraints constrain our understanding and our capacities and our behaviors and everything else in line with them? Or what is the locus of those constraints? I'll come back to that in a second. Maya's another way of talking about what science deals with, I suppose you could say, but I don't want to denigrate that part of it. But things like independent existence appears to exist on the substrate of Brahman. The self is Brahman. There's nothing else other than the self. All is pure consciousness and consciousness only. Whatever happens in the insentient empirical world is witnessed by Brahman. That is pure consciousness. Brahman is all-pervasive. It is both inside and outside. Everything. A Brahman is self-effulgent, self-luminous, and I'll come back to other aspects of that. This is, again, the Vedic, Vedantic views. Consciousness is the reality and the primary substratum of everything. Without the help of Maya, God cannot work as the creator. It's the creational material. And we have the creational material to work with as scientists, as engineers, and to think about such creational material. But to dissociate the creational material from the underlying all of the creatorhood responsible for it, it also separates us, our creator quality, from the creation of our own bodies and what surrounds us, to sort of disconnect us from our own efficacy to take dominion, to work with the creational material. Maya is under the control of God. God enters into everything that's created, both living and non-living, remaining within every created entity. And that's well, it's my part of my belief system. And okay, I'm going to start to jump ahead here. This is a Mac, and I have a PC thumb drive, and so it's. I don't know if I can read over it. From the Doctrine of Vibration, the light of consciousness. I love this. The poet in me likes this kind of thing. The light of consciousness is not only illumines and makes manifest all things, but it is a living light, which reflecting on itself is an infinite self-conscious subjectivity. And that was that gobbledygook, or is that the deepest way you could say something about the ultimate nature of reality? I'm talking about consciousness trying to understand the consciousness of its creator, as well as the creational material that grounds it and makes have languaging and opposable thumb about how to bootstrap yourself back home from the given you're trying to work with. Nothing shines, meaning appears, manifests, or exists in apparent form, if it is not illuminated by the light of consciousness. This is another way of talking about quantum physics, saying there ain't nobody there unless there's an observer. The socks are all curled up nicely in the drawer, even when there's nobody around to know there's socks in the drawer. That's materialism. That's the fundamentalist reductionism, that it's all basically billiard balls and so on. If phenomena were to be anything but light, they could not shine. That is, exist. What is meant by spanda, in its own terms, is a movement which proceeds from the interior domain of undifferentiated consciousness out to the exterior domain of its manifestation, which is created as it moves outward and is destroyed when it returns to the inner state of undifferentiated unity. Interiority, I love that term, tripping me on the tongue. The poet in me loves things like interiority. And I'd have, but most people bounce off it like, I didn't get a PhD in interiority, what are you talking about? Just get a felt sense of it, intuit it, get a feel for it, just like you're trying to get a feel for me, and it's hard to do. I'm not prickly, I'm very soft, I'm full of heart, and I mean no ill to anybody, but I'm an idiosyncratic, as all get out, and that will keep you awake, hopefully, and it will also destabilize or de-automatize your dispositions to find a pigeonhole for me and stay asleep by having the right assimilatory scheme as the pigeonhole things with. I won't let that happen, and I'll do it in a more playful way, a moving target way, or just what the fuck is he talking about way. But you go back to the hypertext and zoom in on it more and go to the detail and get the supportive stuff I also give you, and I think you'll see that it makes sense on a number of different levels. Not always in the one you're getting right now, but just try to stay open and a willing suspension of disbelief or whatever else you want to call it, because there's something here, otherwise I wouldn't have spent all the... I'm 73 now, and I've been working on this since I was about 9. What is interiority is the keynote of both Shiva and material. Okay, I can feel right now that it's. I can't keep reading text specifically; it won't work. Matter and the entire universe are absolutely real as congealed or contracted forms of consciousness. Prakasa is the pure luminosity of self-showing. I'm self-showing you right now. The stuff that makes this microphone is self-showing. And it's self-illuminating. That constitutes the essence and ultimate identity of phenomena. That things appear at all is due to the light of consciousness. It is psychotic to think to remove consciousness from the equation. It is what everything's made out of, and it's what is thinking about everything and how things are made, and it is what the making stems from. It takes the heart out of everything, and we operate in this shadow world, this Platonic shadow world, where we can't turn around because of all the constraints and all the propagandizing and all the consensus reality leadenness and asleepness, the somnambulism. We can't turn around to look at the real McCoy that is casting the shadows. We're just totally caught up in the shadows. And that's understandable. More to be pitied than censored are our fellow human beings. I feel my heart goes out to people who are have been sold this bill of goods because it's all that's been the only show in town, but we're waking up from it. In our lifetimes, we will be waking up in a non-linear, far from equilibrium, expansive, dimensional shifting opening. And I believe that to be the case too. That things appear at all is due to the light of consciousness, and their appearing is itself that light which bestows on all things their evident manifest nature. This light not only makes all things apparent, but is also their ultimate source. The universe is nothing but the shining of the light within itself. The absolute is called light because it is the universal knowledge of the supreme subject which makes the entire knowable manifest. The usual missing ingredient in Western science. That part of it. Consciousness is the fecund womb. Isn't that lovely? Fecund womb, meaning it's loaded, like full of caviar and eggs spilling out, and the polymorphous perverse, the incestuous intercourse of God in seething through itself and making more babies, and the multiplicity of it all. It's marvelous, marvelous, marvelous. Consciousness is the fecund womb from which all things are born, and in which they ultimately unite to rest blissfully. The vibration of consciousness is manifest as the forms which emerge within it. Consciousness must reflect, literally bend back on itself to know itself and what appears within it. Anyway, we talked about the ZPE, the zero-point energy vacuum, things like that. The everything is in the nothing. This has been going around for most of the last century. The hard problem in consciousness studies. I've studied creativity. I've studied consciousness a great deal. I've taught it for decades. I've published about it. What's the hard problem, as it's called, in philosophy? How can one use our physical, only physical matter and energy to account for the personally experienced nature of the subjectivity, interiority, and undeniable awareness that occurs for consciousness when one introspects inward to one's own mental space where one's own thinking, imagining, remembering, and feeling seems to take place, including all the qualia of such experience. Qualia is a technical term, meaning it's in contradistinction to physical information. We're talking about mental, subjective, tasting itself, self-experiencing self, consciousness experiencing itself as consciousness is made out of qualia, the immediately felt qualities of experiences of which we are cognizant when we attend to them, especially introspectively. That's the hard problem. How do the neuronal synaptic, the receptor sites and the slow spreading graded potentials and the dendrites and interference patterns in there and all the neurotubule, Penrose and Company, how you go down to the tubules and within the axons and find at the almost quantum level you can account for consciousness having been born there and dying there, and it's all in there in a physical way to talk about it. That is another psychotic episode, I think. It's looking at the other direction in Plato's cave. For me, personally, it doesn't work for me. The hard problem for an idealist, however, is the opposite. Not how do you get the rabbit out of the hat of all that we experience with living consciousness as you understand at this moment, which is not able to be explained and reduced to the brain. Not able to be. I do not think. And more and more people are beginning to realize. That's why they call it the hard problem. People just throw up their hands in academia and the scientific community. You really can't do that part. So we don't even think about it. It's an anomaly. What's the hard problem for us idealists, though? We also have a hard problem. If all that we take to be objectively real, world reality surrounds us in waking consciousness, if all of that is said by the idealist perspective to exist entirely only within the consciousness that experiences it, how then can we account for the persistent otherness of the physical world out there? How to account for the obdurate self-same invariant nature of objects and events appearing to take place outside of independent and irrespective of consciousness? That's what I got to deal with. How do I explain that? How does a scientist explain consciousness and awareness? That's one thing, a hard problem. My hard problem is all this stuff still here. You know, like Samuel Johnson, who's a contemporary of Berkeley, he's got his cronies with him, and they're out on a walk, and he comes upon this rock, and he comes up to it, and he kicks it as hard as he can, and he winces, and he steps back, ow, 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 And he turns to his gang and he says, "Thus I refute thee, Bishop Barclay," meaning this is not ideas in the mind of God. It hurts. You know, that's the hard problem for the idealist. But, you know, have you ever tried to test things in a dream or a lucid dream? It'll act accordingly. Your reality tests against that level of reality. Hey, it works. It will fulfill the prophecy. What do you want to call it? So the hard problem is, I just said that. So part of that is, specifically, if according to idealism, all we can know and experience exists solely within, not separate from consciousness, then how to account for an independent, physically appearing world when there is no one or no thing present, either human, animal, insect collapsed away function, et cetera, because it has consciousness? What does it take? What's the critical mass to have the quantum physics notion of getting objective particulate reality? I'm not just attached to that view of things only, but it's a question. Here's Berkeley's response. Here's George Berkeley's response. So long as they, the bodies which compose the mighty frame of the world, are not actually perceived by me, or do not exist in my mind, or that of any other created spirit, they must either have no existence at all, or else subsist in the mind of some eternal spirit. The object of sense exists only when they are perceived. The trees, therefore, in the garden, or the chairs in the parlor, no longer than, well, there isn't somebody around by to perceive them. Upon shutting my eyes, all the furniture in the room is reduced to nothing, and barely upon opening them again, is created. There must be some other mind wherein they exist. As sure, therefore, as the sensible world really exists, so sure is there an infinite omniscient spirit who contains and supports it. There is an omnipresent eternal mind which knows and comprehends all things and exhibits them to our view in such a way and according to such rules as he himself has ordained and are by us termed the laws of nature. Oh, that's where the laws of nature come from. Well, wouldn't it be nice if we could petition the Creator to change some of the laws of nature, little suspensions of the constraints occasionally, with enough hallucinogens or enough hyperventilating or enough self-flagellation or whatever it might be, to break the automistic habitual relationship we have with our constraints on our own experiences. Because we plead we can't. It's just nature. That's the obdurate nature. These are the rules of nature. You're taught that, and I've learned over time that the best people to talk to about some of these, the most friendly people to tolerate your weirdness and your idiosyncrasies and your personal models of the universe are people that never had to be conditioned through a PhD to have it collated. Lock all the flexibility knocked out of them. And I've chaired 250 dissertation committees, and I know, but I'm not, even as I'm doing that, I'm not going to be the enemy that makes them stop thinking or being creative or going back to their own creator. You can have your cake and eat it too, I believe. But I love that thing. I'm trying to say an idealist is also saying, yeah, there are laws of nature as we call them. Where do they exist? Like in the mind of God. Well, what the hell is that? And can you petition it? Can you appeal to it? Can you channel its essences? Yes, you can. Stuff's popping up. What does it say? How much time? How much time? Any more time?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Okay. I like this one too. Here's a metaphor for our long-standing externalizing, reifying, meaning making things out of non-things, disposition, like an inverse Midas touch, where we moment to moment turn the surrounding gold of transcendental, pure, coherent, undifferentiated light of the universal consciousness field and its infinite potential virtual objects and contents into the day-to-day localized lead of perceptual object fields and events seeming to lie inanimately outside of and separate from our subjective consciousness experience them. Revisiting a thought experiment. You know Einstein's thought experiment? He imagined that if he was going at the speed of light, and he looked down and he saw a light beam there, since they're at the same speed. He could see the stationary oscillating field. And he did that, and this saw his imagination or his ESP or whatever, saw that and gave him information. He said, well, that's just useful. That's a heuristic device that scientists use to make up thought experiments. And then you get information from it, and then you can act on it, and you can test out hypotheses from it. But your creativity in concert with the universal being's creativity will give you, if you program like a modal logic thing, let there be a universe such that these are the constraints on it, then you get a possible world that kind of plays itself out, and you get the details of it to play with, just like we're in a world we're playing with. All physics and paraphysics are as an immense inner space mental enterprise, like an extended shared thought experiment, or like a now long-standing shared lucid dream, or like using modal logic to stipulate a possible world. What is the ontological locus of such experiences? Example, there's real research that shows that you can slow light down to almost nothing. You can slow it way the hell down. And there's evidence now of superluminary situations. Well, you set up the laboratory situations to verify such anomalous things. Well, where do we go next? And where was the thing itself that you're trying to track and you're trying to document? As long as you're dualistically or materialistic reductionistically positing it out there, you are in this constraint on your own experience, and it isn't necessarily the case, and you're trying to put the glass slipper on the ugly sister's foot or something. Out there in the physical world, completely separate from our human consciousness, or within our own human consciousness, or within the one transcendental consciousness field of which we and all things are part. Well, how do we get at the transcendental consciousness field? One thing you do is, what works for me, as I pray, I petition, I open myself, I open my heart, open my mind, open my energy fields, and I don't know sort of what the hell I'm doing. It's just trust. And I say, you know, I'm your son in whom I would wish you to be well pleased, and please use me, please give me information that will help me to be service to other. That's what my heart keeps telling me. And so I get stuff. I get a lot of stuff. And people say, where the hell do you get that stuff? You know? And I say, well, I get the stuff the same place you get your stuff. But you can get more stuff from that place, dilate the reducing valve if you want to. That's a simple way to look at it. Okay, I know I'm out of time. A quicker view of mainstream, well, that's all this stuff. But I studied a lot. But I'm always looking at it from a larger meta subsuming frame of reference, that it's all happening within a vast interiority that is held still by God or by us levels participating right up to ascended masters and so on. And we hold it still so we can play the game of the bead game, the reality meaning-construing game. And it wouldn't be very interesting to be here if we didn't have the presenting problems and the working through them and the homeward boundness and the homesickness drawing us forth to be doing that very enterprise. All this stuff. But if you stick it back into mind, Hegel's absolute spirit, kind of split off from itself, not quite sure its absolute spirit, or the things it's working with, the symbolic systems, or the things that the symbolic systems denote and are referring to, if all that stuff is still God's stuff or absolute spirit interacting with itself, it's a vast incestuous intercourse of bootstrapping yourself to try to look at your own skull. Alas, poor Yorick, I know he was not animate, and what are you, and you're a skull and you're dead, but it is made out of living substance. It's that whole Eastern lovely view of this effulgent, luminous stuff. Thought experiment, magnification of possible worlds, entire intricately articulated grand unified theories as complexified and materialized. That's not working to read it, but you'll have the slides. My experience, one time I had a marvelous lucid dream, and I thought, what an opportunity! And I got my nose right down to, it was the velvet pillows in a kind of a twilight light in a room. And I got right up to the velvet pillows, and I couldn't tell where the light was coming from, like that Eastern quotes. It was coming from within. There was no external thing illuminating, and it was all self-illumined. And I looked real close, and it was pointillistic. It was quanta. It was quantum fields. And I just marveled at it. I was exhilarated. And then a few days later, I was in some place, and I saw an actual hologram hovering in the middle of the air. And I got up close to it. And do I wake or sleep? What, boxes with things within things within things, pinching myself awake. There was the same thing. It was the same thing. So does that mean, life is one, things are one big hologram? I remember when I interviewed Ken Wilber for my book on channeling, and interviewed a lot of people, and he was one of them. And he said, "Be careful that you do not fall prey to try to explain the whole universe as a big hologram. It's much more than that. It's much." And I said, I know. But I'm glad he knew. Okay, so we really do have to stop. You'll have these. If you want. Fallacy of misplaced locus just means we put everything outside of ourselves. That's what Mother Magdalene in the last talk, she said, don't put it over somewhere else. It's really in you. So the fallacy of misplaced locus is we keep looking at things out there, the billiard balls affecting the other billiard balls, even when we say we're spiritual and all that, when really it's all in one interiority, one being, and we are dissociated from that being. The more we overcome that dissociation with respect to that all-subsuming being, entity, consciousness field, marvelous thing that I love and hope loves me, you get... I love it when the trains go off the track and you say, I can do that too. He doesn't even know what he's talking about. He can't remember what he was saying. And I did lose that train of thought because I can't always handle the pressures of objective time. I throw caution to the winds. I give up. But
may I ask one question?
Yeah. Not yet. Yeah. I said yeah, but he turned the camera off. Yeah, go ahead.
No, don't turn it off.
Okay, but sure, ask me a question, please. Yeah.
Unfortunately, I had to leave, so I didn't see all the slides, but the ones I saw, I didn't see two words. I didn't see the word illusion, and I didn't see the word perception.
Hmm.
You got any comment on that?
Well, I talked about perception to a certain extent. You can't go in and out of a talk like this and come in toward the end of it and figure, what the, you know, put it on me. Everything's illusion. Everything's Maya. Like sonar or something, you're trying to find the limits in reality testing where the boundaries are and what your language is pointing to. The pointing finger, what's it pointing to? Where does the ostended point stop that is you're referring to? And so perception is usually bounded by organic constraints of our organicity. And you can have perception in a dream, I suppose. There's other terminology for these things. I've been teaching psychology for 40 years now, retired, everything is illusion, everything is perception. I mean, ascended masters have perceptions, extraterrestrials have perceptions. You can qualify perceptions, you can have altered state perceptions, you can have all kinds of perceptions. I'm not quite sure, we'd have to talk more about this, but I don't fall back on those too much. Yeah, I have to stop. Thank you.